Welcome to this archive edition of our premier broadcast on Mobile Healthcare Radio. The program you will be listening to was originally webcasted on February 29, 2000, and has been edited for length. You're listening to Insights, our webcast interview program featuring conversations with people making an impact on the art and science of EMS. Our guest today is Dr. Eugene Nagel. Many of you may be familiar with Dr. Nagel's groundbreaking work with the City of Miami Fire Department in the late 1960s and 70s. Some background information and a bibliography are posted on the webpage for this broadcast at www.mhf.net/radio/insights/Nagel29FEB2000. Our archive webcast begins with the interview already in progress and a question having been posed to Dr. Nagel on the genesis of mobile coronary care units and the status of EMS leading up to this innovation in the late 1960s. I hope you enjoy it.
I would say three-quarters or more of the present-day paramedics were kids at that time, and that the middle 60s could be noted for most states, no Good Samaritan legislation. There were no textbooks at that time, no guidelines, no protocols, and CPR was relatively new and was pretty much confined to medical personnel, and the hospital was just getting into the street in the around 1962-3-4.
What I'd like to talk to you about is how the whole idea came about for bringing emergency cardiac care into the pre-hospital environment.
You realize that it's a little bit like saying, tell me about cancer. but let me, I take it that you have skied in your life, Nick?
Yes.
All right, let's touch the top of a couple of moguls. How's that?
All right.
I think it's important to say that some of the history that's been written seems to emphasize points that I don't think were that important. For instance, the absence of the funeral directors in the late 50s, early 60s really was not a major impact. I know that the Jacksonville system makes a point of it, but I would say 99% of the rest of the country, whether the funeral directors would run an ambulance as a goodwill gesture or a way of making money, and whether they did or didn't, really didn't matter. I think that what did matter was CPR. And I think when CPR was discovered in 58 and went public in 1960 with the first JAMA article, and then the following year another article in which the Baltimore County Fire Department was the statistics of using CPR in the street. Those two articles, I think, were key in the development. They were the primordial, if you want, they were the primordial organism. Because with CPR, then the National Research Council and medical bodies like the American Heart started to figure out how it could be spread to the general public. And I would say the Maryland Heart Association was instrumental in developing training materials in those early days. And then the National Heart Association took over some of the Maryland work and put it national. And now for the first time, citizens in the street could do something about sudden death. And it wasn't first aid. And the rescue squads around the country quickly began to do CPR. And the next step probably involved Dr. Day in Kansas City with the development of the intensive care unit. And Dr. Frank Pantridge, a veteran of World War II in Belfast, Ireland, picked up on the intensive care unit and had one of the early coronary care units in the Royal Vic Hospital. And it was Pantridge who decided that let's let's not bring the victim to the coronary care unit. Let's take the coronary care unit to the victim's side. He was responsible for developing what we called mobile coronary care, MCCU, units. He published, and several places around the United States picked up on this and developed their own mobile coronary care units. One of the first, and the history books are correct in this, was Bill Grace in St. Vincent's Hospital in New York, but I would say almost as quick with Glenn Cobb in Seattle, Mike Crowley in Los Angeles, Dick Crampton in Charlottesville, Virginia. Dick, by the way, had one of the first what I would call rural systems. And Jim Warren in Columbus, Ohio. So these were the major MCCU developers.
Now, were these staffed with physicians or with non-physician personnel?
They were all initially staffed with physicians and usually with an additional nurse. And they went in the community, the local community, in response to a call to the hospital generally, saying that, I think my husband, my wife has a heart attack, whatever the call would be. And they would send the unit out. In Seattle, it was called Medic One. In Columbus, Ohio, probably the fanciest vehicle, because a wealthy, grateful patient of Jim Warren, the director of cardiology, had given about $250,000, which in late 1960 terms was a lot of money, and they had a very fancy vehicle. At any rate, the doctor and or nurse, not and or, but the doctor in most cases and a nurse would go to the patient's side. All the cities that I mentioned utilized the fire department as their system, with the exception of St. Vincent's Hospital in New York, Bill Grace, and that was a freestanding unit.
So I guess I'm not understanding the relationship between the fire department and these other units. If the citizen having the emergency would call for assistance to the hospital and this mobile coronary care unit would be dispatched, what was the fire department's involvement at that point?
Well, very quickly after the MCCUs were developed, they were incorporated into the fire department system as a place to garage or base, and with fire department personnel driving. And so they were developed by doctors and mainly medical schools, and then more or less adopted by the fire department in the particular area.
So how did this all unfold with the experience you had in the city of Miami?
Well, while this was going on, we were training our fire rescue personnel to do, obviously, CPR, and we wanted to add IVs and drugs and defibrillation. And so we had already embarked on that program, and we needed a radio system so that the doctors in the hospital at the medical school could give medical orders by radio, and the physician and the rescue personnel in the field could send a telemetered rhythm strip lead two if the situation demanded. But we, from the beginning, looked at it as a MICU, medical intensive care unit, because we didn't want to have a disease-specific vehicle, coronary. We wanted to take care of coronaries, yes. We also wanted to take care of trauma and diabetic complications and things of that sort. So from the beginning, we were MICU-oriented, and without a doctor on board, unless it was for a training purpose. Every system that I know of, with enough detail, it was not just a doctor. Mike Crowley in Los Angeles, Len Cobb in Seattle, me in Miami, we all of us had a rescue officer who was really interested in going down this road and in being able to do more. Len Cobb in Seattle had a fire department rescue person by the name of Alvarez. I had a Captain Padron. Jacksonville had a Dowlin, Chief Dowlin. Baltimore in the early days had a Marty McMahon. So all too often, we're talking about doctors in various cities in the early days, but every one of them that I know of had his counterpart who was an officer in rescue. Now, the rescue personnel were hot to trot, but the chiefs, understandably, were reluctant to do something that might bring discredit on the service or, worse, be a terrible embarrassment. So from the beginning, in Miami, Captain Padron and I and the other officers, Lieutenant Ken McCullough, we formed kind of a committee of three to approach the chief and say, this is what we want to do. And the telemetry and radio connection to the hospital, that went well. That was not a problem. Defibrillation was not that big a problem, although we had trouble finding a battery-powered defibrillator that was reliable at that time. And we bought our first one in 1967 from a small company in Seattle named Physio Control.
I've heard of them.
Okay. And we got a Life Pack. I'll digress for a moment. We got a Life Pack 33, one of their latest models, so named because it weighed 33 pounds. And we rode it on our, we only had one rescue truck at the time, and it was a old Gersten Slogger, anybody in the fire department knows that name, which seemed, it was a heavy rescue, and it rode like it had no spring.
Okay.
It kind of rode like a tank over rough ground at high speed. And we shook that first Life Pack 33, serial number 101. We shook it to bits in about 2 weeks. We shipped it back to Seattle and suggested shock mounts, lock washers, everything else. And the second one that came out of Seattle was fine. And Physio also was fine because it was off and running. But when we got to intravenous techniques in Miami, the chief was very apprehensive. And I had to go in front of the Miami City Commission, the five commissioners, one of whom was the mayor. And he presented me, and I made a short scenario of what a typical heart attack was. I had to lay down on their table, and they started an IV in the... and in those days, we didn't have catheters. We had steel needles. And they put an 18-gauge in me and started a drip. And I made the statement to the commission that I would rather have these trained fire rescue personnel taking care of me in the street than just a doctor that happened by. And they said, go ahead with the IVs. That's how we got over that particular bump in the road.
Doesn't sound like your typical boring city council meeting.
I think we had their attention.
I would expect so.
We got a little blood on their table.
Well, I sometimes there's quite a bit of bloodshed in those city council meetings, from my experience anyway.
In the 60s, there was no ASEP. ASEP was organized and officially about 1971. There were no trained emergency doctors in emergency departments. It was called emergency room then. There were no emergency department nurses at that time. And the medical community in general did not embrace the idea of a non-nursing person, such as a trained rescue person. And in Miami, we called them paramedics to begin with. They didn't want someone like that performing, quote, medical interventions, unquote. And I can tell you that the nursing profession was even more outraged and felt that that these non-nurses should never be allowed to do any of these things. So there was a lot of vocal opposition from both nursing and medicine early on.
Tell me a little bit about the technology of the telemetry. I understand that there was a particular role you had played in developing that hardware.
Well, I had, since I didn't want to be on duty 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, I enlisted the aid of one of the clinical faculty at the University of Miami, Jim Hirschman. And Jim was a amateur radio guy. I was previous to going to medicine, I was an electrical engineer. And Jim and I worked together through this whole thing. And Jim was of the opinion that NASA, since they telemetered EKGs from space, that we could enlist the aid of NASA, but that proved to be not possible. The big names in radio communication were Zenith, Motorola, RCA, names like that. They offered us no help. But at that time, in the middle 60s, there was just starting to be technology that would put a audio signal over a telephone channel that could be coded and decoded into an electrocardiogram. And the telephone transmission of EKGs was, there were several companies that made this type of equipment. And so we reasoned that if it went over a telephone wire, it would go over a voice channel on the radio, of course, which it did. But the equipment that was available could not work in close proximity to a radio transmitter. A radio transmitter would swamp the signal in the little audio modulator, demodulator. So a little company in California, Biocom, developed a modulator, demodulator that would work in close proximity to a radio transmitter through a lot of shielding and bypass circuitry. And so by 1967, we published our first article in a Southern Medical Journal about the telemetry system, which did work.
And this was something that you had prototyped, or was this something that Biocom had built?
Well, Biocom, we went through several stages of equipment before we found one that worked. And one of the old photographs that other people like, I shows me in the communication department of the fire department where we had the NiCad battery, the Motorola radio, and the modulator, demodulator equipment from Biocom out on the shelf, and they had me hooked up as a EKG signal producer, and we were trying out the equipment, and that happened to be the day that we had the first success. And they call it a telemetry package in an egg crate because it was actually milk crate. It was the type of crate that quarts and gallons of milk are stored in.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned that from the start you had been referring to the program with the personnel from the fire department as paramedics. Where actually did that term come from?
Well, when we originally started out to train the rescue personnel, we were looking for a name, and we were also looking for any leadership that we could find. And I went to the military, and they were training me in Texas. There was the major training base for training field personnel for the Army. And they were called Clinical Specialist 1, Clinical Specialist 2. Clinical Specialist 2 was the equivalent, I would say, somewhat the equivalent of a nurse, or maybe a practical nurse. And with some other field modules in the program. At any rate, all of that group of personnel by the military that worked in the field were lumped under the general heading of paramedical personnel. And so we just took the paramedical personnel, we took the term paramedic and Other people had used the word medic. That was a much more common term. And that started in the Korean War. But medic might be anything from a battalion aide stretcher bearer up to including a doctor out in the field. And we wanted something that would not mean medical, and paramedic seemed appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, with something that has continued to evolve so much as EMS has, things that happen early on in the development of a program like this obviously have a lot of ripples and consequent effects on the future evolution of it. If you had to do things over again, would there be anything you might have done differently in those early programs to avoid some of the problems that you might have been particularly frustrated by later on?
Well, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation gave out 44 grants across the country in 1973 for communication. And among other things, that included 911. And in addition, when you talk about 911, you're talking about regionalization, centralization of communication.
Mm-hmm.
If that could have been done in 1969 or 70, two, three, four years earlier, it would have helped a great deal. Early money was important. It was almost impossible to get government money early on in the 60s. National Highway Safety, and particularly the branch called National Highway Safety, had a number of programs designed to diminish death and injury on the highway. And, for instance, one program was alcohol, another program was safety barriers in the road. But standard 11 was emergency medical service. And it was a tiny little branch. There were three guys in it. Leo Schwartz was the branch manager. Bob Motley was his assistant. And they always had a Coast Guard guy attached to it, because Coast Guard in those early days was going to be the air lift arm of EMS. And it started out, it was John Waters in 1966. And he almost immediately quit and went to Jacksonville to become public safety director. The guy that came on after him was Joe Stephanie, and those three people were tremendous in the late 60s in terms of fostering EMS, early EMS. And HEW came in 4 or 5 years later. If I had it all to do over again, I would say that if HEW had gotten its act together sooner, it would have helped. Textbooks. The orange, you remember, have you ever heard the term orange book?
Oh, sure. When I went to medic school in Fort Sam Houston back in the early 70s, we were the first Army class to use that American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons orange book.
You know when that book was started?
No, I don't.
1967. You know when it was printed? 1971.
Wow.
Okay. And it was the first, as you well know, it was the first really organized textbook. It was at the EMT level, but still, it was a basis for going further. And National Highway Safety, then the next year, led a grant to develop the next step, which was paramedic program. And that was awarded the University of Pittsburgh, and a Dr. Nancy Carolyn was elected to write the first paramedic, organized paramedic curriculum. And out of that came all the different textbooks on paramedic programs, and it's been revised, obviously, numerous times.
We have a question from one of our listeners. This is Bill Krasner, and he is asking, as a result of changes in reimbursement mechanisms and further growth of regionalization, the demand for interfacility critical care and ALS transports has increased precipitously. What role do you see for the paramedic in this setting, and how would we establish standards for this on a national level?
Well, you just jumped forward in time by 25 years. I think I was just reading on your bulletin board. Is that what you call it? What do you call it?
The dialogues?
Yeah, your dialogue. I just read this morning something about a course in transport education where a surgeon taught the use of chest drainage and chest tubes, and a CCU or ICU nurse taught a module on CVP and other long line, central line management, and so forth and so on, so that the person riding with the critical patient could utilize Swan-Ganz catheter, could utilize to make sure that thoracotomy drainage was working properly, and so forth. So obviously it has to be what I would call an advanced level person. And sure, it could be a critical care nurse in the vehicle, but I think that you could also train the paramedics up to that level, and you're not going to be doing inter-hospital transport all the time, so they could be an ALS unit part of the time and then put one of the specially trained people aboard for the occasional inter-hospital transfer.
Yeah, that program is actually catching on with quite a bit of popularity in different parts of the country. It's often amazing to watch and see how things develop, almost like people talk about chaos theory with a butterfly beating its wings in New York and it rains in Buenos Aires, sort of a thing. But it's been wonderful talking with you, Dr. Nagel. We're about running out of time here.
Okay.
So what I would like to do is encourage our listeners to go into the dialogues area of our website over the next week or so, and we do have a discussion thread established there in room 22. If you go into the dialogues, which is at www.mhf.net/dialogues, establish an account for yourself there if you haven't had a chance to do so already. And we will be continuing a conversation on this topic of the origins of EMS and Dr. Nagel's involvement with this for a period of time. So I would encourage everyone to take advantage of that opportunity. And Dr. Nagel, I'd like to really thank you for participating in this broadcast.
I'll be happy to participate.
I appreciate it very much, sir.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you, Nick.
Bye-bye.
This concludes our archive webcast edition of Insights on Mobile Healthcare Radio. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Ray Fowler, and you're listening to MHF.net Radio.